I saw something glowing beneath the tea tree.
Look at that.
So I pulled the camera out and I stuck my arm in.
What could go wrong?
What have you done?
Something snapped.
Looking back on it.
Doris moment.
But it's a little bit emotional.
What did you do?
All right, I'll tell you. Clop, click, clop.
No, I tried to throw that sword away.
Oh, no.
Your whole being screams.
And suddenly...
it was in my blood.
Life's changed.
I love that.
Very, very confronting.
Like it was.
For a long, long time.
When it began. 20 years of conversations on ABC Radio.
Hello, welcome to Conversations. As part of our 20th anniversary this year, we've been digging down into the archives and mining out some choice favourites. As you can imagine, it's been very hard to choose just 20 from all the amazing guests we've met over the years. Today, it's my conversation with Sydney barber Charles Lomu.
In a garage in Blacktown in Sydney's western suburbs, Charles Lomu is a youth worker who teaches young guys to cut hair. This wasn't the original plan for Charles's life, but he's pretty happy with the way things have turned out. In his early years, Charles lived with his grandparents in Tonga, reading the Bible with his grandmother, helping out his grandfather. He moved back to Australia and became a talented rugby player, but then he went off the rails for a bit. After a stint in prison, Charles tried his hand at various jobs. He'd been cutting hair all his life, but now he discovered that barbering gave him peace and friendship and independence. And more than that, it gave him an opportunity to lift up other young guys who were just like him once. Charles took in 5 apprentices and taught them not only how to cut hair, but also how to open up and talk and to make their way in the world. Hi, Charles. Welcome.
How are you doing, Richard?
I'm well, sir. Thank you. You still do the barbering work, of course, in your barbershop setup in your garage. What kind of a setup have you got there?
I've got a simple setup with just 2 stations, and I've got one station that I look after myself, and then next to me I have another station that I'm training my daughter in, and my wife also shares that station as well, so she does braiding as well, and together we deliver a service that's more focused on the type of hair culture that we're into, and that's urban style hair culture. And it's quite simple, and I just love the fact that it's in the home environment. It just helps my children see that there are other ways that they can make a living and still have time for family.
You're known as Six Fades. What does that mean?
Six Fades, yeah. So when I first started barbering, before I took barbering on as a career, I actually did some music. Recorded an album and I was signed to a record label and I did some music, and my title, my artist name was 6 Pound, and which comes from a story that's tied to my village back in Tonga.
What's the story? Can you tell it?
Yeah, the story, it's my grandfather's village back in Tonga. It's called Limatua in the island of Vava'u. And in that island, the story goes that they had this event that they were all preparing for a special noble that was coming by. And the women of the village were preparing all the catering and the food. And part of it was they made this order for these 6-pound tins of corned beef that were meant to be delivered to the docks the day before the event so that they could have it featured at the event. And what happened apparently was that the order came the day after the event. And so the women of the village went down to the wharf and to express their disappointment as the orders of 6-pound tins of corned beef came off the boat and landed on the wharf. They grabbed the tins and started just smashing the tins around the wharf.
Right.
And so the onlookers saw that the women of my grandfather's village were doing this, and they became labelled the 6-pounders. And so that was all my life growing up. Whenever we have a wedding or we have a special occasion in our village, the tins of corned beef always come out and they do, and they perform this smashing on the ground.
The ritual smashing of the corned
ritual.
Beef. So this is an act of anarchy and this kind of a built-in as a musician at the time. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I took on that title, 6-pound, to pay homage to my grandfather. And then when I went into barbering, I went with the name Six Fades, but now I've changed it to Lawnmower Fades.
Right. It's a way of cutting the hair on the guys you can't?
Yeah, it's a way of cutting the hair so that it graduates from a short length to a longer length, but we do it in an urban cultural way. So it's it goes from a skin fade from a razor length to a longer length. But, yeah, it's pretty fancy. Before, back in the day, you just asked for a blend.
Right.
Now there's like a taper fade, a skin fade, a low fade, a high fade, a burst fade. Yeah, there's all different types of fades now.
Is it all fine art, is it, to get it right?
Yeah, sure is.
Because I'm guessing if it's not even, it looks terrible. So you've got to get it right, exactly right then, don't you?
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah. So you've got to, there's a lot more focus on understanding how your clipper works. So you've got to understand the features on every single clipper and what each feature, each setting can do. And then that allows you to be able to control the actual fade in the haircut.
So it's like a paintbrush, except in reverse. In other words, you're taking stuff off rather than putting stuff on the canvas of the head.
Absolutely.
I think I've noticed about when the difference between the way men and women get their haircuts. You know, women's hairdressing salons are pretty lively places. There's a lot of chat going on. Women are pretty happy to be there. They're having a good time. It's different with the barber thing. Guys, when they come in, and I think I'm like this too, pretty nervous, you know, and a bit shy. I think what guys are trying to say is to the barber is, can you make me look cool, mate? But that sounds bad, so they won't say it. What do you think is going on there, the nervousness of guys when they come in to get their hair cut?
Yeah, I think with men, what I've found is that sometimes men don't want to admit that they care a lot about the way they look.
So, but they do.
But they do, you know. And I could see which one's more than the others just by the way they, every little step of the haircut, they're like checking over my work. So I think for a lot of men, it might be a bit of a challenge. But I am finding that over time, men in general are becoming a lot more high maintenance. And so they are becoming a bit more aware of their grooming.
You and I are having a bit of a chat. I'm asking you questions. You're answering my questions. Is this what you're doing when you cut hair?
Yeah. Basically, I think it's the best way to spark conversation is asking questions. And the mindset I always keep in mind, and I share with a lot of the young ones that I teach barbering too, is that always remember that the customer is the expert on his own story. And if there's anything that he knows better than anyone, it's their own story. So just ask questions.
Now, I talk that to guests all the time before they come on the show. I use those exact same words. That's fascinating. So you try to keep your questions pretty open then, rather than very pointed?
Yeah, always open, always open. And there's your general questions like, how's your day? Or you got much planned on this weekend? They're the general ones. And it's just depending on their response, you can sort of guide the conversation from there.
Do they get stuff off their chest, these young guys, when you're cutting their hair?
Yeah, I have. I've had a lot of those experiences where we've had some really in-depth conversations and, you know, conversations that I guess for some reason, when they're in the barber chair, there's just this level of trust that a barber, I take it as a privilege that we have, that customers or our clients feel like they can speak to us. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that it's one-on-one. And one-on-one, I find, maybe isn't something that a lot of males are comfortable with putting themselves in that situation to have a one-on-one deep and meaningful with another male. But when you're going for a haircut, I feel like the haircut disguises the fact that there's a one-on-one deep and meaningful conversation going on. So one of my cousins who's been a long-time barber, he said, one way you can always view barbering is it's two friends catching up, and the benefit out of the bonus out of that is they get a haircut out of it.
As they're sort of getting stuff off their chest, the other thing is, you know, ideally they're looking better and better too. They're looking sharper and sharper as the conversation goes on. Yeah. I'm not even kidding you. I'm sure that's therapeutic. You know, I'm sure that's helpful to them as that's going on.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is therapeutic, and the fact that they know that they're coming to you and that they know that you're going to make them look good when they leave and feel better about themselves, I find it is therapeutic. I find the comment that I hear the most when the haircut's finished is like, just what I needed. That's exactly what
really?
A lot of
the guys lovely.
Say.
What a nice thing to hear.
Yeah.
Really. So they walk out just with standing a bit straighter and feeling a bit taller as they walk out.
Yeah, the confidence is there's an instant boost of confidence, yeah.
Is there music in the room and a guy singing while all this is going on?
I don't have a guy singing, but I do have music playing on the speaker. But it all depends too. Depending on the clientele that I have for the day, I'll look over my booking list, my appointments for the day, and that will help determine what music I play. So I have some clients who like to listen to, say, older R&B. Then I've got some clients who like to listen to new music. But then I have clients who are older than myself, and I love the depth of knowledge that they have of the music they're into, say, from back in the 70s. And so I'll play the music, and then I'll ask them for just a conversation base as well. I ask them, like, is anyone you recommend I should listen to? And I always find that, like, it becomes a journey of experience for myself as well.
Yeah, and that's another way into talking about all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Just starting a conversation with music.
Yeah, that's right.
Like I said at the beginning, you spent your earliest years in Tonga with your grandparents. Mm-hmm. What were they to you when you were little, Charles?
My grandparents, to me, were like my mum and dad in my Tongan culture. In the Tongan culture, we have this thing called pusiaki. And pusiaki basically means it's the same as an adoption. So I was adopted out to my grandparents, and I'm the second of seven siblings. So my grandparents took me to Tonga with them after I was born. And I lived there with them until I came back to Australia just before I started my schooling years.
What pictures of Tonga do you have in your head? Can you remember much of that time at all?
I don't remember much of that time at all, but I remember when I went back again when I was eight with my grandmother, and we went to go and look after my great-grandmother there. But my grandmother told me a story of when she took me there when I was after birth. She was at the airport when we were changing flights, and what had happened was, because the flight was delayed to the next day, we had to stay in a hotel. But that day at the airport, someone had done a bag snatch on her, and she had all these food for me to feed me with. And so they put us in a hotel that night. And she said she just remembered that when she saw the bed at the hotel, when she walked in the hotel room and saw the bed, she felt like she was unworthy to sleep on the bed. So she just put a sheet on the floor, and then myself and her, we just laid there and had to sleep overnight on the floor, and then we went on our way to Tonga after that.
How religious was she?
Very religious. She was very religious. I'd say more than religious, I'd say she was very spiritual, because I find my grandmother was more about, you know, more about the doing than I'm trying to impress other people. So she would always be the type of person that would wake up every morning reading the Bible, going to bed, reading the Bible and praying. And when I was young, I used to love listening to her read, but then she would, like, take the time to explain some things to me and explain to me the principles of the things that she was reading. And she was just someone that I felt like was a teacher to me. And that's one thing I always valued about my grandmother and my grandfather, was that they would sit me down and teach me things. And it was never done in the way where it was dressed with guilt or done in a way where it was forceful. It was sit down, help me understand. And it would hit my heart all the time, and I would feel like what I'd done was wrong. I'd really feel it, and it would make me feel like I didn't want to disappoint them.
Obviously, she was a really good and kind person. I wonder why she thought she wasn't good enough for that bed, or is that the right word for it, in that hotel room, or was the bed, was she just distrustful of luxury? I wonder what that was. What do you think?
Yeah, my grandmother, she came from, like, very humble beginnings. And so my great-grandfather had died when she was young. And so my grandmother had to leave school when she was young to help take care of her siblings, because her mother now had to take over her father's role and start traveling to the plantation to bring the food home. And so she had to step into the mother's role and be the housewife to look after her younger siblings. And so my grandmother was always appreciative of just the simple things. And she wasn't used to luxury. So growing up, whenever we sat down to eat, and my cousins, we sat down to eat, and my grandmother would feed us all, and we were full. If there was any food left over, my grandmother would sit there and eat everybody's leftovers. Because she just thought that would be a waste of food if we threw it away.
It's a nice way to make a point. Rather than force the kid to eat the plate, if she does it, then that's kind of cool, isn't it? That's clever.
You're listening to my conversation with Sydney Barber and youth worker Charles Lomu.
So you came back to Australia to start to go to school. You're living with your dad. And how was your dad with you? Was he different in the way he tried to bring you up?
Yeah, I think it was a challenge for my dad because I looked at my grandfather as my father and I yearned to be my grandfather all the time. So when I came to live with my dad, I think the difference was my dad was feeling the pressure of working to provide for seven kids or you know, just trying to provide for a household and living in the Western world.
In a hectic city.
Yeah. And trying to get used to just the hustle of the new life in the Western world. And so I felt like my father had a lot on his plate. And so I could see the contrast of my grandfather and my father's way of dealing with things. My father didn't have the time that my grandfather had to sit down with me, discuss, and quality time. My father was always working hard. When he came home, he was really tired. And so... yeah, I saw a big contrast in the quality time that I had with my father. But he was a man who wanted good for us. But I think the pressure was a bit much for my dad.
It sounds like your grandparents were really good at kind of communicating with kids in a kind of a loving and moral sort of way. Was your dad affectionate with you and your siblings?
Well, with my father's generation, I feel like affection was something that was meant to be just understood. Like, you were meant to look at the hard work he was doing. You were meant to look at the fact that we have food in the fridge and to understand that he
from
loves
that,
us.
Right. That's got to be just understood. It's just implicit.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. And that's so... I never really heard the words, I love you, from my father.
Was that seen as unmanly, do you think? To do that sort of a thing?
I think it's interesting because the word, the translation ofa'atu in Tongan, which means I love you, we say it a lot in Tongan. It's actually such a normal part of the way we talk. So if someone leaves your house, you naturally say I love you.
Oh.
But saying it in English, it seems so different because it's not a natural thing you would say. Growing up, I probably heard those words more when we were, like, being disciplined.
So maybe it's more like, yeah, right. So maybe it's more like the local culture in Australia that was more like that, because we don't do that very often in Australia. Sometimes happens, but you don't traditionally say, I love you, as someone's walking out the door.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What did he want for you?
He wanted for me and my brothers to all be professional rugby league players.
Why rugby league players? What did he think that would do for you? I mean, assuming he was a fan of the sport, but what did he think that would do for you?
Oh, I think he thought that it would be the best chance for us to succeed, to earn a good living, and also help the family up, you know, to help the family up financially and just set us up on a good path. So I'm not too sure at what point that... became an idea to my father. But what I feel was when he took us down to the local football club, Elwood Saints, to start playing footy and started to see how much we enjoyed playing the game and then started to really gravitate to understanding how the game works and I guess we probably were effective at it. And my father thought, this is probably a worthwhile investment.
Did you enjoy it back then?
Yeah, I think I enjoyed it. I think I really did enjoy it because I think playing at that time in my life, I think playing football in a team that in the club that I went to, it helped me to, I guess, learn how to just meet and start communicating with other people, you know, to get used to people outside my family circle because we have a tight family growing up. We only really stuck to ourselves. And so going to play football was my time where I got to hang around other people, I guess, or just be exposed to other people where we were doing something that we enjoyed, where there was a coach who became, you know, like invested in me as well, that was outside of my family. And I really enjoyed it. I found it fun when I was a kid, yeah.
Who coached you when you first started? Tell me about this coach you had, because it sounds like she was a major influence on you as a kid.
Yeah, we had a woman coach by the name of Robin Connor.
Is that unusual at the time to have a woman coach for a bunch of big, strong rugby league players, playing boys?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, I didn't really recognise it at the time, because she had actually been coaching us since we were really young, under sevens, and just over the years she just remained our coach. Yeah, I honestly looked at her like a mother. She was an Australian woman, and you know, I would spend a lot of time visiting, and they would spend a lot of time picking me up for games and just keeping me involved. And I just remember when they'd go away on family holidays, because they had a son that was the same age as me. His name was Luke. We became really good friends, so they'll take me away with them on holidays. And yeah, I really enjoyed just the life lessons too I'd learned from Robin. I still remember a time when we were sitting there watching another team's game, having conversation with the boys, and Robin was invested watching the other game, and she was just observing the way the other players were playing. And we're just having a general conversation, and I swore in the conversation. And I saw Robin's attention just completely switch off the game. She turned her attention to me and she said, "What did you say?" And I knew straight away I must have done something wrong. and she basically, you know, addressed it, and she said, "Don't you ever use that language." And I respected her so much for pulling me up. And I just respected the fact that this was someone that I had a lot of respect for. And when she pulled me up for that, like, I didn't have a problem with that. I was like, she's always been like a mother to me. So if she said this to me, she must really care about me. And so I listened to her.
And there came the day when you were a teenager and the word came in that your grandfather in Tonga had died.
Yeah.
How were you told?
My grandfather, when I was growing up, I always promised my grandfather, I would tell my grandfather and my grandmother that one day when I can drive, I will buy a car and I'll take you guys driving anywhere you want to go. And I will become your driver and traveling, because my grandfather never drove, my grandmother never drove. So I always promised this to them when I'd get older. And I remember one day I was asking my grandfather, "Would you ever visit Tonga again?" And he said to me, "I'd only go back there to lay to rest. That's the only time I'd go back there." So we had this conversation, and that was that. And then one year came during my teenage years, and my grandfather's getting ready to travel to Tonga. And so we're all saying goodbye to him, and I remember, like, going to say goodbye to him, and he was really emotional. And I was like, "Grandpa, don't be too worried. I'll see you again. I'll see you again." But he was really emotional. And so when he went to Tonga, he ended up passing when he was in Tonga. And when he passed, my mind went right back to that conversation we had where he said he'd only go visit again to be laid to rest. And so I was a bit like, the way the news came to me was, I was in bed. It was a summer holiday. I had my cousins over. We were in bed, just lying down, sleeping in, like a normal school holiday. And the news came. Grandpa had passed. And I remember getting up, and I didn't want to believe it. And so I had to go over to the house where he lived, and everyone was there. And that's where I found out that that it was true. It was a reality. And I lashed out, you know. I just sort of was in a rage, because I couldn't believe that it actually happened. I don't think I ever prepared for this moment, for this time. And so,
didn't you think it would come one day? And I mean, it's the way of the world. It's the way of things. You just weren't ready for it, though. You hadn't given it much thought.
Yeah, it's true. You know, you're right. It is the way of the world. And for some reason, I just never thought about them going, passing. I just took it for granted, I think, that I had them there all the time, and never thought about the fact that there will come a time where I would have to go on without them.
I suppose it was a bit like losing a parent rather than a grandparent too, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
That's harder. I think it's one thing to lose a grandparent when you're a teenager, but to lose a parent.
Yeah, that's how it felt to me. It was the closest person in my life I'd ever lost. And so when I got the news, this was right on during the time where I was just starting to take rugby league from local level into representative level. And so my father had organised for us to attend some trials to start getting introduced into the younger grades in the NRL clubs. And so the club that we were going to trial first of all was the Sydney City Roosters. And so when this funeral happened around the same time, I just thought, okay, I'll be going to Tonga for this funeral. Didn't think anything else of it. So what happened was the family gathered together and a decision was made that they would send a certain number of the family members over for the funeral. And I automatically thought I'd be included. And then I was told that I wouldn't be going because my father said, I have to play the trial game for this rugby league game to try and make it into the representative club. And so I didn't have a choice in that. And that, I think, was something that really ate at me. And
it'd feel like a betrayal or something.
Yeah, I just thought, like, this is an opportunity to say goodbye. I will never have again. My opportunity to say goodbye is right now. And so I had to live with that, but it was something that harbored a lot of resentment in me for that.
Of Conversations on ABC Radio.
Today you're hearing the story of youth worker and man who cuts hair, Charles Lomu.
You were saying before, after your grandfather died, your dad didn't want you to go to Tonga to go to his funeral because you were up for like some rugby league trials. What did that do to your feelings about rugby league?
It changed the way I viewed the game. It went from something that I actually enjoyed, really enjoyed playing, to becoming something that prevented me from having that opportunity to say goodbye to my grandfather. So
poisoned it.
Yeah.
It was poisoned then.
Yeah, and I sort of viewed that from that point on, I'm no longer playing this game for me. I'm now playing it for my father. And I just lost that personal enjoyment for the game after that.
How self-destructive did you get at this time, Charles?
Yeah, at this time I started drinking a lot and I started to distance myself from people who were actually, you know, beneficial, you know, for me, the people that were actually like Robin Connor, my grandmother. I started to distance myself because a lot of my my cousins, I didn't feel like I could actually talk to them about this because they viewed him as a grandfather and they viewed their father as a father. But I viewed my grandfather as my father. And so for a lot of my cousins and that, even though they knew how close our relationship was, you know, I felt like they couldn't really understand where I was coming from. So I kept it to myself and I started acting out in a lot of the habits that I picked up. So a lot of drinking and then slowly a lot of the just the recreational drugs that came with it and just a lot of rebelling against my parents. I ended up hanging around a circle of friends that I would catch up with and we started getting involved in petty crime and just to make money to support our habit. And it just ended up eventuating to the point where we got in trouble with the law, with the police. And then when the pressure from the police kept mounting up and I kept getting in trouble with the police, then my father felt that he couldn't control it anymore and ended up sending me away overseas to New Zealand to live with family.
How did things change once you got to New Zealand?
It was a bit tough because before I boarded the plane, my father said to me, when you get to New Zealand and people ask you whose son you are, you make sure you don't mention me and your mother's name. And so I boarded the plane with those last words from my father.
Oh, that was that hurtful? That must have been so hurtful.
Very. It was very hurtful. But I boarded the plane and I thought, I'm just happy to get out of Australia right now. So I got to New Zealand, living with family, and then the change of atmosphere. I didn't know hardly anybody except for my cousins that I was living with. It was refreshing for me. So I started joining the local community at volleyball games up the road. So I'd turn up every afternoon playing volleyball. You got all these big island men jumping up and spiking the ball at little kids, you know. So I was learning. I felt like it was a training. I had to learn to be confident. Eventually got to know the guys, then felt like a little brother to these guys. And I really enjoyed the experience. But through that experience, it made me want to sort of develop more of a spiritual side. And that's where I started in New Zealand for me.
Right. What kind of spiritualism are we talking about here?
So I actually wanted to get back to what my grandma used to do and reading the Bible.
Go to church?
Yeah. I started going to church and just visiting and trying to rebuild my relationship with God. And I remember one of the most popular accounts that my grandma used to read to me was about a young person who was lost in the woods and God called him back. And I thought to myself, I'm that young person at that time. I need to be called back. So I ventured out on my journey then. And I was in New Zealand for a little time. I started working in the strawberry farms, which was beautiful for me because it was all other Tongan workers there. And when lunchtime came, everybody brought the pots out, the lunch boxes out, everyone brought it out. We all sat under a tree and everyone was passing the food around. And I'd never seen that before. I thought, wow, this is a whole different experience. I felt it was fulfilling for me at that time in my life because I was going through, you know, a time where I was a bit haywire, and it grounded me again back to the roots that my grandma taught me about.
That sounds so nice. Why did you leave? What brought you back to Australia?
Well, what brought me back to Australia was I went for a holiday in Tonga, and my father and my siblings and my mother went to Tonga as well. We all agreed to meet there for holidays. And then, without my knowledge, they arranged for me to have a ticket to come back to Australia. So I came back to Australia because there was a opportunity to return to representative football again. So I came back to Australia to play football.
How did you go once you were back in Sydney again?
I tried to do my best with the circumstances. And I've discovered really quickly that there were a lot of unresolved issues. It was just expected that I was supposed to slot back in and just go. And so I felt like all of those unresolved issues just came up. I couldn't keep them down. And so because of that, my father and my mother and I agreed that I should leave home because my father was worried that my example might rub off on my siblings. So I left home. And
well, there's heavy shame in all of that, isn't there?
Yeah.
And your self-respect must not have been great. How old were you when you left home?
17, going on 18, yeah.
And what happened once you were out of home?
So when I went home, I went out of home, I was living in a boarding house. And at the time, I felt like I had freedom. I learned very, very quickly some things about life that I didn't know. Now you've got to start paying your own rent.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got to start buying your own food. You got to wash your own clothes. And fortunate at the time I was in a relationship where a young girl was helping me out. And so I settled in Redfern at the time.
And then things went bad again.
Yeah, things went bad again. My relationship with a girl ended up falling apart. We had a child. We actually got married in that short time. And by the age of, I'd say 21, I was divorced, and I really felt depressed from that. But at that time, not knowing I was depressed, I just went right back to the drinking, and everybody around me was like, drink it away. Don't worry about it. Let's just go out and have fun. But same thing, I just had more pent-up, unresolved issues inside that I hadn't dealt with and no one to talk to. And It sort of held me down for a long time. And the saddest thing for me was, I think about my son. He had to endure an experience or some circumstances that he had nothing to do with. And that's something that I felt, you know, always made that probably the most regretful experience for me.
So you were sent to periodic detention? What did that mean? How does that normally work?
You usually have to turn up at 5 o'clock at a point. They meet, you pick you up, then you get locked up until Sunday, and then you come out. It's like a last straw before you go into full-time lockup. And so I had to do that for 9 months.
Right, to give you a taste of prison, so you go, well, I'm not going to go there again.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think the only reason why I had that as an option was because I had children and I had that I was responsible for providing for, so they were trying to give me a last chance. And while I was in there, I really started thinking about my spirituality again because I had stopped it. But in there, I found it really tough because of the atmosphere where everyone's trying to protect their manhood, you know. And for me, I never really bought into it. I felt when I was in there, I always felt like these aren't bad people. These are just people who made bad decisions. Because I'd have one-on-one conversations with guys and then I'd see how they were in the yard in front of everybody else. And I recognize that there's a big front going on for a lot of people. But I just struggled because you don't really have that kind of support sometimes in there unless you got someone motivating you. And that came during my time I was doing that sentence. A guy came in and it turned out that he knew someone else that was a mutual friend between us. And so...
Was he a fellow prisoner or someone else or a youth worker or something?
So he was a fellow prisoner. He said, I heard that you were studying the Bible with a friend of mine. I said, yeah, I was. He said, I was about to get baptized. And I said, how are you supposed to get baptized and you're here in jail with me? And then he said, before I decided to get baptized, I realized I had some warrants on my name and I felt that it wouldn't be right for me to go ahead unless I go and clear my name. And so he turned himself into the police station and he ended up inside with me. He helped me rebuild my spiritual journey up. And he's another big, formidable type of guy too. So when we both realized we were on the same journey, we were in different pods. So we decided, why don't we approach the security guard in the jail and ask him, could you let us share the same cell? And he looked at us and he said, you're joking, right? Why would I put two big guys together in the same pod? You guys were probably just trying to get together to try and take over or run amok in your pod. And I like what Jack said to him. Jack said to him, if you allow us to cell up together, the only thing we want to do is share things with the prisoners, the other inmates, that will actually make your job easier. And to my surprise, the guard there let us cell up together. While I was there, Jack was sharing a lot of things to me, but it wasn't until this one other inmate said to Jack, I love what I'm learning and I love these things that you're sharing. But, you know, my wife's not going to have me accept me doing this stuff. And I was just there relaxing, laying down, just, you know, just daydreaming. And Jack turns around and says to him, well, you can learn as much as you want of this stuff and take in as much knowledge as you want. But if you're not willing to do any of it, then it all means nothing. And I sat there thinking to myself, wow. All these years I've been acquiring knowledge and I haven't put it to use. And so when I finished my sentence then, I ended up really committing to my spiritual journey and it became a life-changing experience for me.
Today you're hearing my conversation with Charles Lomu, who learned how he needed to live the rest of his life while spending time in prison.
Do you think you learned that lesson in an even broader sense? Like, you know, you've been acquiring all this knowledge, practical knowledge, apart from spiritual knowledge, but more worldly knowledge about how to go about things in the real world.
Absolutely. I learned that anything in life, if you have good ideas and you don't put it into action, then they just remain good ideas and means nothing to anybody. And it helped me in all areas of my life, even with my wife, when I'm dealing with my children. I might have good intentions for my kids, but if it comes out in a way that's just interpreted to my child as anger and fear, those good ideas don't mean anything until they're interpreted and translated across in the same way.
So once you got out of periodic detention, what did you do?
I just focused on my family. We ended up moving out of the area. We were living with family and we decided for the first time in me and the mother of my kids' experience, it was the first time ever, we decided we're going to move into an area we've never lived in before and we're going to start our own journey. And so we moved to Blacktown, trying to focus on, you know, just the simple things, family routine at home, it was a huge game changer for us.
How long did it take you to realise you might be a barber? Like for money, I mean, rather than just cutting the hair of members of the family.
Yeah, well, I started cutting hair, I think, in 1992. So I was about 12, 13 years old. I started cutting hair because my cousins used to cut hair at the back of my grandma's house. And so I used to love sitting there and watching them cut hair. And because they had migrated from Tonga to Australia, they were still living like they were in Tonga. So they were cutting each other's hair in the backyard. Where my father was like, no, 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 go get your haircut from the barbershop. You know, so we'd go to the barbershop, but I'd go to my grandma's house to watch them cut hair, and I was more fascinated with that. And so they ended up letting me start to cut hair, and I got the love for cutting hair then. I was always cutting hair, cutting friends' hair, cutting family's hair. I was cutting hair after work. I'd come home and just cut hair for everyone and anyone that I knew. But then in 2014... cutting a friend's hair, and he said to me, it's actually scriptural for me to pay you for your services. It's the right thing to do. He said, because you're a man that's a father and you're looking after a family, and while you're out here cutting my hair, I'm taking time away from your family, and it's also costing you electricity. And it's only right that a man should compensate another man for his services and his hard work. That was the plant. That was the idea that started it. And I was like, really? And then I had another friend who came for a haircut, and he comes with this little box that looked like a tissue box. And it was an empty little box. And he said to me, this is from my wife. And she said, you have to start charging now for haircuts. And she won't allow me to come back here for haircuts if you don't charge me anymore. So I started off with $5 haircuts and just eventually just kept growing. And as my clientele base kept growing, I started slowly just decreasing my time for my day job and ended up doing barbering full-time from home.
Did it let you reclaim the idea that you once had with rugby league before the bad times, that you might actually enjoy what you do?
Oh, I absolutely love what I do. And yeah, and you're right. I think the thing that made me really go deep into thought was, I thought, how did it take me this many years to not see an opportunity in something that I love so much that was sitting right under my nose?
George Orwell says the hardest thing in the world to identify is the thing that's right in front of our nose most of the time, or the hair on our head, maybe in this case.
Absolutely.
Indeed. So in 2016, you ran a 10-week course for 5 young Islander guys, mm-hmm. mentoring them in the art of barbering. Tell me about the original 5, as they called themselves. It's kind of a thing, isn't it, the original 5?
Yeah, the original 5 were a group of young guys from out Western Sydney. And they came and joined the first barber program that I was invited to host from home, from our setup at home. And, yeah, we took them through 6 months of training. Every Thursday night, we take them through teaching them about the origins of barbering, teaching them about the history of the trade, and then also talking to them, teaching them about customer service, and then into the actual craft of barbering. And then after that 6 months that we took him through that training, we ended up hosting an exhibition at the local art centre in Blacktown. And so these young guys had the opportunity to start cutting hair for people in the community who came to sit in the chairs over a period of time. I think it was like a couple of weeks or a month that we had that exhibition going. So they were now able to take everything that they learned in that 6 months and now put it into practice with people they'd never met before. Out of that original 5, one guy in particular, he was the one that probably was unsure of why he was there in the start. When we interviewed the original 5, I remember this guy named Kiko, he said to me, I asked him, what brought you to this program today? And he said, I only just tagged along with my other friend, because he said that he was coming here, and he said, why don't I just come along? So he came along, and he actually turned out to be the guy that went on to manage barbershops, and he's still working as a professional barber today.
I saw a story on the feed on SBS that Pat Abood did with you and those guys, and I heard them talk. They're lovely men. And what's interesting hearing them talk is, again, they have that kind of, they have a lot of good language, emotional language. They can talk in a way that not a lot of young guys really can about how they think and they feel. Is that just like a kind of a fun, well, not a fun, but an interesting byproduct? Or is this something you really want them to have? Like, this is what you have. Is this what you want them to have or want them to learn from you?
Yeah, I think barbering is a platform that allows that for us to be able to share that with young people. And I feel it's something that's really, really important because going back when we talk about all those times when I never had an opportunity to talk about these unresolved issues and this pented up resentment, I felt like the way I expressed myself was opposite to, was really reflecting the way I was feeling. So with these young guys, I really wanted to give them the opportunity to learn how to communicate openly with other people, with all different walks of life, because I felt like coming out of school, you spend from the age of 5 to year 12, you're used to just spending most of your time around your peers. But once you leave year 12, in the big world out there, you've got to learn how to talk to all different people. And communication is key in the barbershop. Sometimes I feel like communication is so key that if you're great at your customer service and great at treating people and great at communicating with people, that you still be able to survive in this industry, even if your haircuts are shocking. Remember more how they feel at the end of the day. So if you know how to treat people in a way where you make them feel important and your haircuts can be average, you still be able to make an honest living.
It seems like you've become the man that your grandparents really wanted you to be. You've got one of their best qualities. Is that what you want to be? Is that what you've been aiming towards?
Yeah, very much. As a father, the way I father, a lot of times I reflect back on the feeling that I received, the way I felt from the way that my grandmother and grandfather trained me. So with my own children, as they get older, I notice every single part of their journey requires a different type of father. So when my older children went into teenagehood, some of the things that I thought I had a hold on, taught me that, I need to adapt here. And so one thing I keep in mind all the time is asking myself is, how did I feel when I was at that age? And what do I wish was said differently to me that would have allowed me to respond differently? And so a lot of those times I tune back into how my grandfather and my grandmother conveyed a message to me.
It's been really lovely speaking with you, Charles. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rich, for having me.
That was my conversation with Charles Lomu, youth worker and barber in Blacktown in Sydney.
Conversations. 20 years of standout stories.
We've been having a wonderful time plunging into the archives. We've got so many stories from the thousands of guests over the years. Sarah spoke to Colin Hay of Men at Work.
The record company gave us a deal for a single. That's how much confidence they had in us. They said, well, we'll let them make a single. So we made Who Can It Be Now, and it went to number 2. So they thought, well, we'll let them make an album. So there are a few things that came together at the same time synchronistically, which caused our success, I think, contributing factors to it. There was an American record producer in Sydney at the time, and he was brought to see us by Peter Carpen, who signed the band, and he said he wanted to produce us, and he was a very good record producer. He knew what he was doing in the studio because, we did not. So he was very good at producing the songs and producing us. But I think it was one of those things where I'd been dreaming about this for 15 years. I'd been kind of plotting, scheming, and we were quite confident in ourselves. We were quite self-assured in the sense that we thought that we had something different. And, of course, we'd been playing to live audiences before we made a record, and the live audiences kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, even though we hadn't made a record. So we were playing to sometimes 1,000 people in Melbourne, and that was ridiculous, and we didn't have a record deal or anything, you know. So we knew that people liked what we did, but when the first album hit, it was really, this is just kind of snowballing, little spot fires all over the world. America was the last country to really pick up on the band. So we had like between 6 and 9 months before they finally kicked in over there. You know, it felt like we were in control of what was going on, but of course, you know, you're trying to cope, really, you know. Mm. Yeah, and you do the best job you can, really. And I thought I knew everything, and it turns out that I knew nothing.
Well, what did you think you knew? What do you mean?
Things like, I believe you kind of hit certain periods of your life where instinctively you're supposed to hit your stride, you know. And I seemed to hit my stride at the right moments. I recognized that. I recognized that there was something outside of myself which was at work here, and I just had to respond to it. So I found myself standing in the light, and you go, wow, I'm in the light. So you respond to that, and you got to step up. You got to perform, or else you shy away from it, or else you sabotage it. You know, you can do all kinds of things to mess it up, you know. And I wanted to do greater and greater things. And with a lot of things, I think, where you have 5 or 6 men together, communication skills are very limited. And I think that Men at Work essentially was a very huge thing. It was a huge thing which was kept very small by what I consider to be small-mindedness and people not recognizing the phenomenon of what we were, you know. You know, having said that, probably it wasn't a band that was really destined to go the distance, like a lot of bands do. I have great respect, whether it's the Rolling Stones or U2 or other bands you mentioned you could think of that seem to, you know, stand the test of time and seem that there seems to be some kind of soul or unifying force within the band. And that's what we didn't really have in the end, which was really the sad aspect of the band Men at Work. The band Men at Work was definitely, it was 6 people, 5 people on stage. We had a manager as well. And the 6 of us created the success to become the biggest band in the world. And then all of a sudden, we were not.
A few years ago, you reached out to a young musician, Justin Bieber, who on the surface seems to be a very different sort of musician from you. What could you relate to him, what was happening to him, or what could you see as the possible pitfalls that I guess you must have had to negotiate when your career was in that kind of place?
I think that at that particular time, I felt for Justin Bieber because everyone seemed to be slamming him for his behavior, and everyone seemed to be negating or minimizing his talent. What I felt that I wanted to express to him or to anybody for that matter, but at that particular time, he was just the guy that was kind of seemed to be getting hammered by everybody, that the thing that will never leave you is your talent, is your ability to do the work. The phrase that I always come back to, which I firmly believe in, is that if all else fails, you know, creativity can always be a salvation. People can't take that from you.
That's Colin Hay. If you'd like to hear the whole of that conversation, please go to our website. This conversation was recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people. It was produced by Alice Moldovan. Executive producer of Conversation's 20th Anniversary Collection is Carmel Rooney. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.